Music there of John Zorn, and this is a very special edition of A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. My name is Michael Bates. We will be featuring John Zorn in two episodes of the podcast, and what follows is a conversation that happened between Dave Douglas and John Zorn at the WNYU studios. It took place on September 12th, 2013. As we always say, if you enjoy these interviews, please go to the iTunes website and leave us a rating and review. That helps people find this information. Previous episodes that we've done here at the podcast include Henry Threadgill, Miguel Zanon, Desron Douglas, Myra Melford, Matt Mitchell, and many, many more. We're looking forward to making a bunch more episodes, and we welcome your comments and suggestions, if you have any, and you can write us at podcast@greenleafmusic.com. You can also find these episodes at greenleafmusic.com, which is a music company owned and operated by Dave Douglas. You'll find sheet music, tour dates, blog posts, and recordings by Dave, Donnie McCaslin, bassist and composer Linda O, Matt Ullery, yours truly, Michael Bates, is over there as well, and many others. And by the way, if you visit there now, there's a special offer on Dave Douglas's DD50 box set, which is three CDs celebrating his birthday, turned 50 this year, and there's also a DVD of some session footage over there. And now, without further ado, here's the first part of the interview between Dave Douglas and John Zorn.
Hey.
Dave.
We're rolling. So, John Zorn, thank you for joining the podcast.
A pleasure. Always good to see you. How you doing, man?
Great. So, where do we begin?
Anywhere you like. What would you like to talk about?
I'm probably supposed to ask you about Masada, but
we heard
this Henry Brandt piece last night, and we heard your piece for six trumpets, kind of unbelievable evening of music, tribute to Butch Morris as well. And
it's nice to be at Roulette again. I haven't been there in a long time. They fixed the sound on the ceiling they put in those panels. It really helped tighten the sound up, I thought. It's good space now.
Remember the old space?
The original Roulette?
Where was the original?
The original was on West Broadway, and that's where we premiered Cobra 30 years ago.
1983?
You know, it was like 84 October, so 29 years ago, and it was Jim's house, and it was nice. It was really nice. John Cage would always drop by. He liked late-night concerts.
He played in your first Cobra?
I wish.
who did play in your first Cobra?
Well, it was Bill Frisell, Zena Parkins, Christian Marclay, Jim Staley was there, a man named Bob James, not the Bob James you know, but someone who used to do sound effects. That was great. It was a crazy band.
Wow.
So Roulette now is a beautiful big space, and they've kind of tightened the sound up, and I thought the trumpet sounded great last night.
Sounded fantastic. Yeah. To hear 52 trumpets, pretty amazing. But tell me a little bit about, people talk all the time about the game pieces. And I think there's a feeling sometimes that because you use the word game pieces, there's an aspect to it that's not serious. From having been around you as long as I have, I know that, you know, on a certain level, of course it's life, so there's humor and there's everything. There's every emotion. But I know that the rules of those game pieces took a lot of serious consideration and thought as a composer.
Absolutely.
To come up with a way of organizing improvisers so that different situations can arise.
More than that, so that they stay interested, they stay pumped, they stay engaged, they get inspired. The job of a composer, in a way, I think of composition now as catalyst. It's something that is almost a platform for musicians to then do their thing, to feel connected, to feel that their work is being appreciated, to feel challenged, to feel, just to feel. A lot of times I find compositions shut people down. And what I try to do when I put things on a piece of paper, and ultimately that, you know, that's one way that composition goes. It can also be an oral tradition, and we'll go back to that in a second, vis-a-vis the game pieces. Mm-hmm. But when you put something on a piece of paper, you should be able to give it to a musician, and they should be able to look at it, and just from looking at it, get inspired. Go, whoa, this is going to be fun to play. This is going to be a challenge. This is going to be difficult. But I have a feeling, you know, this guy really knows what he's doing. It's going to be worth the effort. So whether you're working with improvisers or classical musicians or jazz musicians that like to negotiate changes and what have you, that want to blow at some point during the evening, or noise musicians or rock musicians, each of those communities have a different set of rules, a different set of communication skills. Rock bands a lot of times get together and work things out, you know, in a room. Things aren't always written down. Things are memorized. Classical musicians like to have it all written down. But, you know, when I work with rock musicians, I have things written down, you know, but not everything. Sometimes I describe what needs to happen. That is also the case with classical, where if there's things written down, but I don't want to overmark the music to the point where someone feels like a robot. You have to leave room for interpretation. And so as composer, I feel like what I need to do again is act as a catalyst, enable people, because execution ultimately is what it's all about for me. Music is about people and how they do it, what they do, what's going on, how they feel about each other on stage. This is really important part of a musical experience to me. So with the game pieces, I'm dealing with a community of improvisers. Each musician is capable of standing on stage for 45 minutes and doing a solo set of completely unique music that's their own, that they've worked out on their own. They have an idiosyncratic language that they've developed through their own practice procedures, their own pedagogy. Now, as a composer, I kind of saw my role, how can I harness this language in such a way that the musicians don't feel exploited, like I'm just stealing their language and using it, that I'm not telling them what to do, because improvisers don't like to be told what to do. They want to just play.
Right.
But also create some kind of format, some way of interacting that would never happen on its own, without the composition, without the kind of sounds that happen in
catalyst.
Cobra could never happen
just
in an improvised situation. So that there's a reason for them to do the piece. So that's when I started thinking about the game pieces where, and of course it comes from ideas that go back to Earl Brown, to Cornelis Cardew, possibly to Stockhausen, to a lot of ideas that were happening in the 50s and the 60s. And I kind of tied a lot of these ideas together into these structures where, for example, duos. You look at a player and play a duo with them. Then you stop and you can do a duo with someone else. Now you have 12 musicians on stage and you just say anybody can do duos whenever they want. Then you could have six different duos happening at once, or two happening and then two others happening, and then the overlap. There's all kinds of possibilities. So in the 60s, there may have been like a Fluxus piece called Duos that just had that as an instruction. It would go on for 45 minutes or an hour. What I tried to do was create a more complex series of these kind of exercises that could be called upon at any time by any of the players. It's very democratic. It's not like one person in front of the band is making the decisions and they do what the conductor is telling them what
Even
to do.
In the case of Cobra, the prompter doesn't have that control.
The prompter is one of the players, so can make a decision. But what my idea, and why I use the word prompter, who stands in front of the band, is the prompter, as in opera, a prompter is hidden under the stage and is only there to kind of help a performer in case they get a little bit lost. The idea of the prompter is to relay information from one player to the other. Because at the time, you know, the early 80s, late 70s, there was no digital, you know, nothing. And if you wanted to set up a series of monitors on stage where people could communicate with headphones and that, hugely expensive. I found, you know, a very simple way of conveying information from one person to another in the group by using cardboard cards. I could go down to a shop and buy it for $5, cut them up, different colored signs. Each one has a different letter on it.
Canal
D for duo. Yeah, right. Exactly. Go down to Pearl. Pearl paint, boom, done. Do my little art project. And I come up,
and
the music is written on one little sheet of paper, but it's good for 1 hour, an evening of music.
Right.
Well, and
in the right hands.
In the right hands. Well, so there's all these kind of different ideas, trades, duos, pool down beats, all these different ways of having the players interact with one another.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They have to be aware all the time of what's going on. They can't just close their eyes and blow.
Right.
Things are constantly moving. There's constantly information. And the prompter basically is in the front to be able to get one person's idea up and convey it to the rest of the band.
Mm-hmm.
But in the process, the prompter can also make decisions. But everybody in the group can make any decision they want at any time, pretty much.
Right.
That kind of, freedom was interesting to an improviser. It wasn't,
Well, it's interesting because when you talk about, I don't want to paraphrase too much, but, your music writing being about people.
Yes.
Right? And writing for a specific vocabulary.
Or a community.
A community of people.
Yes.
Who have a certain background or a certain set of practices that they use. But would you say then that the game pieces are a separate kind of community than some of the other pieces that you write for? You know what I'm asking? Does that make sense?
Well, in a way, they were written for a certain community. They came out of
specific
a certain community. Kinds of musicians, It's possible to do Cobra with a bunch of classical players.
Mm-hmm.
I would say 30 years ago, I would have really resisted that because they weren't trained in improvisation.
Mm.
These pieces are written for improvisers.
Okay.
Nowadays, we have classical musicians coming out of conservatory that very much want to improvise. Maybe even they took some improv courses in their curriculum, and now I'm a little more open about letting other people get involved in the Cobra experience. But at the time, and one of the reasons that I pulled the piece away from being a public, performance piece that anybody could do, was that people did not understand that the word community was very important in the performance of this piece. What I found when I opened it up, anybody can do the piece here, go and do it, was that a lot of people used it for their own kind of ego gratification. You can obtain a certain amount of power in Cobra in making calls and enabling different musical situations. And I found people weren't thinking of the music. They were just thinking of themselves. And
well, that raises an interesting question for me. So, in the sense that the people that you're describing didn't play your piece well to your expectations.
There have been people who haven't.
Right. It has happened.
Yeah.
Do you find the same thing with your other pieces?
Of course.
So for different reasons, or would you say that it's generally what you're describing as the problem, that they're taking your piece and using it for their own means?
I think that can happen in any musical situation, whether it's country music or jazz music or classical music or whatever.
Yeah.
I think, the musicians that I've been involved with that are in the various communities that I work in are open-minded musicians that understand the big picture, and they're out to make music. They're not out to get themselves off. Musicians like that don't belong in my scene. They're not part of the team. You've got to, it's really teamwork is what makes music exciting for me. It's about people who are working together. If there's someone in the boat that's not rowing and everybody else is rowing, that guy's got to go. I got to read him the riot act. I got to say, man, either you get with the program and you start rowing, or you're going to end up in the water and we're going to leave you behind.
Right. But I heard your string quartet up at the Miller Theater a few months ago, your new one. And it was an unbelievable performance. Everybody was activated on every level, and it was so exciting. But I didn't get the feeling like it was a moment where you were going to jump up and say, okay, you got to get off the ship.
Those guys, there's no reason to say that. Not with those guys.
Even on a piece on that level, the technical challenges.
There have been many, many cases where I've been at a rehearsal for one of my exactly written classical pieces where I felt like this is just completely not happening. They're playing all the notes, but that's not what it's about. Wow. That's just a skeleton of what the music is. For me, again, the music is people, the music is feelings. You know, what you saw on that stage at that time at Miller was not just the notes from the piece The Alchemist. Yeah. What you saw was four musicians who are completely dedicated, who really care about each other in a deep, meaningful way, who love me, who love my work, and who are completely committed to delivering that to an audience. And that's what you feel when we're on stage with Masada. We love each other. And ultimately, that's what I think people are responding to when they get up on their feet at the end of the night. It's not just, you know, that we're so virtuosic or this, that, and the other, yeah. because there are a million sax players that play better than I do. I do something unique, you know, but you know, I'm not the best sax player in the world, nor do I want to be. What we do is unique because of our individual interaction within the group as a whole. It's the teamwork.
And you would apply that to any...
Any one of my situations is about teamwork. Oh. And as a leader, you know, the one who's bringing the music to you guys, again, it's my responsibility to come up with music that's going to excite you. You know, but in addition, I have
usually,
to be a good...
You know, my initial glance is, uh-oh, this is going to be impossible.
And then we do it.
And then we do it.
But and then we're in the middle of doing it, I make it even more impossible.
Exactly. Well, it's usually in the course of a sound check. And then when the gig happens,
it goes up again.
Twice as fast.
Yeah, exactly. And twice as many cues and twice as many, you know. And so, but see, that's the crucible. That's, you know, where I got to turn the flame up.
But I get a feeling you've always been like that.
Yes, yes. But I've honed my skills at being a band leader over the, you know, 45 years of doing this, where, you know, I understand a little bit more about personal dynamics, group dynamics, what I'm here to do, part of a band leader's job is sometimes to get mad at people. If things aren't right, you got to get them right. And my way of doing it is taking care of that problem immediately, not wait until, you know, a day later. By the way, yesterday.
I'm familiar with that. That's part of your process. but that makes me want to ask you a question. Like, does that, you're saying, you know, how did you express it? It was such a good... You've gotten better at handling the dynamics.
Yes, yes. Group dynamics, personal dynamics.
Do you feel like that goes into your writing as well? That's an influence on what you do when you're at home writing the music?
No, I think a band leading skill is a very unique skill. It's something that Greg Cohen and I have talked about this a lot, is that it's kind of a dying art. It's not something that's being taught in schools. I don't know if it can be taught. At times I've taken musicians under my wing. I'm not someone who wants to go to school and be a teacher. I don't want to really do workshops. I believe in teaching by example. But over the years, I've taken certain musicians under my wing and I've invited them to rehearsals, invited them to mastering sessions, recording sessions. I've gone out to lunch with them. They've come to gigs. They've come backstage. They see how I work. You know, it's kind of a hands-on approach. And I've done that. And honestly, you're either a leader or you're not. Either you have that personality or you're not. You know, I've tried to pass down, you know, as much knowledge as I have, but I think there's a kind of personality type. You either need to have that ability to that energy, that charisma, that intensity, that, you know, power, whatever. I don't think of myself in those terms. I just do what I got to do. But in the past few years, I've been reading more about leadership, specifically General George S. Patton, which I've been really interested in for a long, long time. And this is someone who... Yes.
I want to come back to this for sure.
George S. Patton.
I want to come back to this for sure. But I just want to say that we are... you mentioned education and workshops and stuff, and so we're recording this conversation courtesy of WNYU and Brandon Peckman here, who's engineering this for us, and we're very grateful. But also because we're at NYU, I'm happen to be parked on University Place.
He's got to go feed the meter. The man has to feed the meter.
We're going to be in big trouble.
All right, so put a track on.
I brought this track that you would like to hear because you play such incredible saxophone on it. It's actually an instance in which I arranged a Masada tune that we were not recording with the quartet. So it's Greg Tardy on tenor sax, and I'm in the section on trumpet, and you're playing alto, and it's Greg Cohen and Ben Porowski on drums, and it's your piece, Vehuel. And I'll be right back.
And then back to George Patton.
Thank you.
Puel, Smokin' John. On
sounds
Zorn
so beautiful.
On alto saxophone.
What a band that is. That's a smoking band.
Ben Perowski, Greg Cohen.
Greg Tardy. Slamming, man. It's really beautiful. Thank you for including me in that. I know I resisted doing it. I didn't want to do it. I didn't think I could cut it, but
why did you
I'm cutting it.
Doing it.
I really didn't think I could cut the chart the way you wanted it to be, but it's slamming. It's beautiful, man.
I'm glad you agree with me.
It's killing. It really sounds, it's at the edge. The tone is killing. Everybody sounds great. And an alto comes out of nowhere. All of a sudden, wow, man. It's like got a little Dolphy edge in there.
I knew you had it in you, John.
And you've been listening to a conversation between Dave Douglas and John Zorn. And that was part one of a two-part series that we've been doing here at Noise from the Deep. So once again, please do stop past greenleafmusic.com. Go to the iTunes website, leave us a rating and review. We'd love to hear from you. And you can write us at podcast@greenleafmusic.com. So keep an eye out for the next installment of A Noise from the Deep. And we will be featuring part two of an interview between Dave Douglas and John Zorn. My name is Michael Bates, and we will see you soon.